is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio, editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And coming up, an open banking revolution or letting the big boys off the hook.
The idea is that we will be able to give websites or applications secure access to our bank account details.
2 years, £5 million and 766 pages later, the watchdog produces its final report into retail banking. Not gone down too well in some quarters.
People have to be interested in comparing current accounts to actually use it. Otherwise, they're simply not going to bother. They're going to stay with where they are. And that's why I find it a bit disappointing.
Does it go far enough to break the dominance of the big banks? Simon and Rachel give us their take. A week on, we look at the impact of the Bank of England rate cut and Brexit vote on annuities, investment trusts and homes. It's a Brexit bonanza we're hearing for property hunters.
I think it's just a period of uncertainty, so people are not sure what to do. So some people are taking homes off the market, but then there's also a case where people are actually quite keen to move on.
One in three homes for sale had its asking price slashed after the EU vote, a wobble or a seismic shift. We also answer your question with another rate cut on the cards. Is it better to fix or to track your mortgage? And savers, where can you look to make money in this post-Brexit Britain without gambling your nest egg away? From current accounts to property, gold, shares, even wine and classic cars, we size up the risk. Also coming up, watch out, Simon takes aim at the more controversial of our many taxes, yes, inheritance tax. Find out more about this. We also focus on travel, rip off credit card charges, why it doesn't pay to pay in pounds, a trick to get a bit of cash back from a missed flight. We are asking today, airlines harvest millions in rip off credit card fees, we're reading. Annoying, sneaky, hidden rip-off fees that really annoy you. Simon, Rachel, a very good morning. Simon, to you first, those annoying fees you have to pay.
Do you want a list?
Just one will do, but by all means.
Well, there are many things, many fees and charges and penalties that annoy me in my life. But I think the one that probably annoys me the most is the old booking fee on gig tickets, right? Which is just a racket, basically. And we campaigned against this many years ago. And we spoke to people in the industry. Basically, these booking fees are actually often put on not by the promoters or you know, by the venues themselves and selling them. They're put on as a way of making extra money so that basically the ticket price will go, should be shared out by the venue, the artist and the promoter. And then the extra bit on top will go to them as well. So it's not even necessarily the ticket agency slapping these on top of there. They annoy me, but the way that they have then turned into charges for delivering your tickets as well. So not only do you pay, you know, 10, 20 pounds worth of booking fees on your tickets, you then have to pay for the tickets to be delivered to you. And you also have to pay to print the tickets off yourself. That is, to me, the absolute pinnacle of sneaky fees, charging someone to print off a ticket themselves on their own printer.
Would you just prefer to pay a flat-out rate for it, then?
Absolutely, 100%. But this is the price of your ticket, this is what you pay. It's a massive con, and all of the people in that industry should be ashamed of themselves.
Rachel, for you?
Anything that rips you off because you're loyal. I say loyal because it's more emotive. It could also just be laziness. But people who don't switch for whatever reasons, the big one that's come up this week is around insurance. Insurers have been told that from April next year, they're going to have to tell you what you paid last year so that you can compare it to this year to see whether or not you're being ripped off. The fact that none of them have been doing this till now, and that they really only will do it because they've been told that they absolutely have to, and that this is necessary in order for us not to be ripped off, I think is so mean. Why would they charge people who have been customers for years much more than new customers?
I agree with that. Simon, I have actually written a list, but then I've been on air a little bit longer than you have. Cash point charges. Hotel early check-ins, late check-outs really get me. And discretionary tips at the end of bills. It is not discretionary unless you want to look like a really miserable person and tell them to take it off. Shouldn't tips be rewarding good service, I ask you?
We actually had that once. It was in Covent Garden. We shouldn't have been eating in a restaurant in Covent Garden. That's the lesson to be learned from life, isn't it? Basically, it was a big meal. There was maybe 10, 15 people there. And the bill came up like something ridiculously small, like £1.60 short or mm-hmm. something. But everybody had paid by card. The waiter came up, was like, it's £1.60 short. And we said, that's fine, just, you know, take it off the service charge, which was basically a discretionary service charge. Of like, it was a big one as well, 15% or something, bearing in mind this bill was probably about 600 quid. They said, no, we can't do that. And we said, what? They said, no, we can't do that. That's a discretionary service charge. And we said, yeah, it's a discretionary service charge. Take the, you know, we're £1.60 short. Just take the £1.60 out of that. It wasn't being tight. It was just like, look, yeah. just do it like this. It's sorted. We were on our way out of the restaurant. You know, it's easiest. We can't do that. At which point, my friend who'd organised the dinner threw his toys out of the pram and said, right, that's it. You're not having the service charge. Got the whole bill back and we had to redo the whole bill until he took the whole service charge off.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, weekdays from 9 till 12, wants your feedback. Contact the programme by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
A very good morning. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the finance website of the year. This is Money. You're back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with LS9. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. Now, a revolution in banking or tinkering around the edges. 2 years, £5 million, 766 pages later, we got the final report from the competition watchdog into the £16 billion retail banking industry. The conclusion? Well, we could soon have a souped-up mobile app to manage our accounts and help us switch.
The idea is that we will be able to give websites or applications secure access to our bank account details so that they can give us advice of a kind that's quite different from the details of advice that we can currently have. By looking at the details of a bank account, they can say, and it isn't necessarily just about switching bank accounts, you're incurring too much in the way of overdraft charges, you could save money by getting an arranged overdraft from your existing bank or from a different bank instead of having unarranged overdrafts, you could save money by switching banks. That kind of advice can only be given by someone who can actually see how you as an individual are using your bank account. So that's what I mean by saying it's going to become much easier for customers to make sensible decisions, and we'll change the relationship between customers and their banks.
And that was Alistair Smith from the Competition and Markets Authority explaining what the apps could do, part of the so-called open banking revolution. We could save a whopping £92 a year. It could be easier to switch, caps on overdraft charges, but the banks get to set their own. I should point out also that they rake in £1.2 billion a year from unarranged overdrafts. Challengers, consumer groups and indeed privacy campaigners are somewhat unconvinced. Now, they argue the proposals don't go far enough in tackling the dominance of the biggest banks, or the exorbitant fees we have to pay and could leave us vulnerable to fraud. Harrison Kelly is from one of the challenger banks, TSB.
Banking is the only industry where customers don't get a monthly bill. They don't know how much their bank is costing them. We put forward two proposals to the CMA. The first was very much about making it easier for people to move their bank account. And this is particularly true for people who have a heavy overdraft user. If you're charged a lot on your overdraft, it's difficult for you to then switch your overdraft to a new lender. But under our proposals, we would propose something called a credit passport, which would essentially mean that you could switch your overdraft to a provider which has fewer overdraft fees. Therefore, it would cost you less in the long run. And of course, there's lots of switching offers around. So just by switching, you could get 150 quid for switching your bank account, which could take some people out of their overdraft. So that was the first thing. Then the second thing that we wanted was something called a monthly bill. It's a bill that you get each month, which shows you exactly how much your bank account is costing you.
Well, that's what they wanted. That was Harrison Kelly there from a challenger bank, TSB. Now, I know neither of you like the fact that TSB is called a challenger bank, but we'll put that to one side for the moment and focus on this investigation. Rachel, tell us a little bit more about it. What was the issue or the problem that they were looking at and therefore attempting to solve?
The problem that was identified was that people are not getting a good deal from their banks. People don't shop around, which means that they get ripped off. People are spending more money than they need to on different charges, being whacked with massive overdraft fees, these sorts of things. So once again, we have a multi-million pound investigation, which takes several years, the conclusion of which is, yes, you are being ripped off. to solve this, it's your responsibility to shop around. And to help you do so, we're going to create a huge database. We had it with the energy suppliers a few months ago, and now we've got it with the banking sector. It seems a sorry state of affairs that the only real solution that is identified is us having to move our money around the whole time. It's not that big a deal anymore. It's quite easy to do, but it is more of a faff than we need. It's, again, the onus is on us to do something about it. There were other things that were identified throughout the course of the investigation that could be done. Perhaps caps on overdraft fees would have done it, or breaking up some of the banks, creating more competition in the market. But these were all rejected for something much more low-key. The database, again, we've got these issues the same as we did with the energy suppliers around data protection. Do we really want all of these banks having access to all of our money and all of our personal information around transactions and how much money we have? It's probably fine. It's just that the risk, if it's not, is quite high.
Well, there's been a string of high-profile cyber attacks, hasn't there, on high street lenders?
And that's it. And it does just make us all a bit nervous. So whether that's, I don't know, whether that's really an optimal solution. It just seems a bit weak yet again, that it just would have been such an easy kill, this cap on overdraft fees. And they didn't do it. They bent yet again in favour of the banks. And maybe they'll do it if it's voluntary, but the fact is they're making 1.2 billion at the moment out of it. And they don't have a lot of, you know, spare change at the moment, so they're going to keep milking that.
Also, you talk about fraud, you talk about security fears and all that. Privacy campaign is indeed of this large database as well. But what about the fears, I suppose, of collusion and also to use that information to sell you more products?
Yeah, and does that really help? We've got the same problem here as we do with the energy suppliers. So the idea with that one, again, is that all of the suppliers will have access to our information and they'll be able to send us letters saying, did you know that you could get a better deal? One, would this not put people off when you've got a bombardment of information that doesn't necessarily encourage you to, one, take, be proactive to make the right decision? I mean, when you sort of sign a contract with a particular company, you acknowledge that they are going to need a certain amount of your personal information, fair enough, and you sort of weigh up whether or not that's a decision you want to make. But you don't sign up in this situation. You don't give permission for all of these different companies to have your information. I think you can opt out, but you have to have a lot of confidence in every single one of them.
So, Simon, Rachel's not a fan. Defend this open banking revolution.
Well, so, I mean, they're talking about this open API, right, basically. And what this would do was would essentially provide this, you know, sort of gigantic flow of data. So if you imagine, you know, this sort of just this current, and basically people would be able to just tap into it to find information. And APIs are the key to how a lot of the stuff that you would use on the internet works nowadays. So, for example, things like feeds of Best Buys that will come into our Best Buy tables. When people search for a car online, you know, there'll be an API feed of data that's tapped into by developers. And it's how developers basically build all these cool things to do. So you might find that off the back of this, some very smart people go off and they build some things that make your life easier and make your life better. But there is this big concern around privacy and the way that it will be used. And this question of, well, do you really want your account data to be open in this way, your spending and everything like that? And I think that what it fails to do, realistically, is to actually address what the problem is. The problem is that twofold. People don't move banks, right? So people are just, they're apathetic. I have some sympathy with the banks here. Mm-hmm. I struggle to see what more they could do, considering the fact that many of them will give you free money, offer you a massively higher interest rate on your cash in your current account than you will find on an easy access savings account, and will do all kinds of things to reward you for moving. What more could they do in that sense? Very little. But all of that stuff is basically appealing to the people with money. Mm-hmm. They're appealing to the people at the top of the pile. And like most of the stuff in finance at the moment, basically, if you're at the top of the pile, then the current account market looks great for you. You can go get your £125 or £100 to join First Direct, which has the best customer service. You could go get Halifax to pay you £5 a month with its reward account. You could go get all your benefits off the Santander 123 account. You know, you're in a great position. And all of those people will give you an overdraft. And if you stay within the overdraft, you could probably borrow for free. If you're at the other end of the scale, though, the current account market doesn't look so great. You're the kind of person who's being hit by unauthorised overdraft charges. You're probably living in your overdraft, so actually you don't feel that you could even switch bank accounts because you're worried that your new bank won't give you an overdraft, and anyway, you can't pay off the existing one to get out of your existing banking situation. Mm. And you're probably finding that you could be ending up paying higher charges from those unauthorised overdraft fees than you would be paying if you took out a payday loan. And I mean, we campaigned against these bank charges years ago, and unfortunately, in the court battle that went on, the banks eventually won, and that has allowed them to continue with this. And what they do is they deliberately lend people money that they shouldn't be able to have in order to charge them penal rates of interest and fees, and they're profiteering off it. And that needs to be stopped, in my view. So I think that what the CMA should have done is said, right, no more of this game, because this is hampering competition. So, you know, we can concern ourselves with the people at the top of the tree who aren't switching, but realistically, they've got every incentive to switch and they just aren't doing it. But what about the people at the bottom of the tree who really do struggle to? And there was a great column written on this by Larry Elliott, actually, in The Guardian this week, who basically said investigations into the structure of banking in Britain have become rather a cottage industry. There have been 11 separate inquiries into the sector in the past 17 years. Thousands of hours have been spent taking testimony from expert witnesses. Millions of words have been written, and nothing much has changed. As in 1999, the big four of HSBC, Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds have a stranglehold on the market. It's like all of this effort.
Yeah.
And nothing has really changed. I think what will change it, though, is a lot of these upstart, new, genuine challenger banks. Not necessarily the TSBs of this world, which has been around since 1810. So in my mind, doesn't qualify as a challenger bank.
Therefore, how do you understand a challenger bank? Like who?
So I think people like Atom Bank. But I'd even say Tesco Bank qualifies, right? Because Tesco now owns the whole of that bank. Yes, it's been around for a while, and it was originally a joint venture with RBS, but it owns, you know, the whole of that bank. So there's Atom, and then what was the one that you spoke to?
Tandem.
That's the one. That's the one I was trying to get the name of.
And
yeah.
It's Metro, which is bigger, but still, I'd say challenger.
So there's a few of them out there.
Yep.
Not enough. Is that the problem?
It's still very early days with them. And I mean, I spoke to Tandon. They believe that you need two things for people to switch. You need sort of the default position that they're in to be suitably rubbish, but you also need a really good alternative. That's part of the problem. As Simon says, you can get incentives, cash incentives from some of them. But once you're in the door, a lot of them much of a muchness in terms of rates, in terms of fees, that sort of thing. But if someone offers something that is significantly better, and a lot of them will do it around data. This is what Tandem will do and what Atom is planning to do as well. You have to subscribe to this idea that you hand over all of your data and your life will be better. But if you do, and if you do trust them, you know, they're looking to do all sorts of things.
Isn't this
like
what the CMA is suggesting anyway, that we hand over really all our data?
So they'll do things like look at your bills and say, we've seen that you're spending X on your gas and electricity. Would you like to spend less? Say, you know, like a push notification.
And
you
nudge
can say,
theory.
Exactly.
101 you can just behavioral say, economics.
You can say yes or no, and it'll all be done for you. And so they'll be helping you with your budgeting, with your, you know, insurance costs, all that kind of stuff. Sort of almost like a more of a lifestyle option. And so once you start getting something that people trust in the marketplace that is significantly better than what we've got, then maybe people start to think more seriously about moving.
Just like a quick one. You mentioned there earlier about investigations into energy market, into banking and the like. The average person would be forgiven for wondering what, after years, millions of pounds, these reports are actually for, when it really always seems to end up with the punchline that it's all down on us, consumer needs to switch. What is the point of these reports?
Gosh, that's a miserable question. I suppose you can't just...
Is there one you've come across that is truly revolutionary, that's absolutely changed something?
That's made a significant difference.
Simon?
No.
If there was one, I better get diluted down. I guess the closest we've got to is the suggestions of, you know, splitting the retail and investment and trading arms of the banks, you know, this ring fencing. But by the time that actually comes in, you know, we might all be sitting in our rocking chairs with our pipe and slippers, and it will probably have been watered down so much that it will be meaningless. So, no, I don't think that these reports are bold enough. And then you have that situation where the problem is if they stage a real attack on one of these industries, the problem is a lot of these industries are so concentrated that, you know, they worry about the consequences of it.
often it happens. And we saw it with these two that we've been talking about, also the one into telecoms around Openreach, that the regulator will sort of put out a draft report. This is kind of what we're thinking about the situation as we see it thus far. And it will generally be a lot stronger than the final result. So then you'll get the big players muscling and saying, oh, actually, I don't think that sounds like a good idea. And then by the time the report comes out, things will have either been watered down or just completely disappear. The top line in the CMA report into the energy sector was, they put a number in billions, I forgot how many it was, that we were being overcharged by our energy suppliers. That number was just taken out. That was the cool number. That was the mm-hmm. thing that for us was the proof that people were being ripped off. But it was contested and contested. Oh, no, I don't know, you can see it that way, really. And the number just was extracted from the report. Again and again, we see this happening.
So no.
No.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Now, of course, last week we got a rate cut, another expected before the end of the year from the Bank of England. Shortly we'll be exploring the best way for savers to beat the cuts, but let's look at the impact it, and indeed the Brexit vote, is already having on the likes of annuities, investment trusts. But first, house prices. Brexit bonanza for property hunters, it's being called. We're hearing this week, one in three homes for sale had its asking prices slashed after the EU vote. That's according to the property website Zoopla. The average discount they found was over £25,000, almost the equivalent of the average annual wage. But the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors did say the market was beginning to pick up again after what they've called a brief Brexit wobble. Paula Higgins is from the Homeowners Alliance.
Yes, I think it's just a period of uncertainty. So people are not sure what to do. So some people are taking homes off the market. But then there's also a case where people are actually quite keen to move on. So there's a recent survey out today that said that 45% of the people who actually have homes for sale, they want to get it pushed through before negotiation starts on Brexit. So there's a bit of an anxious time, a bit of uncertainty. So it is a bit more difficult to buy and sell at the moment. Don't panic, because also, I mean, the thing is that, you know, things after this uncertainty, people need to move for a variety of reasons. So there are people looking to move and people to take the opportunity. You might need to, you know, a bigger place, you might need to downsize. So do push with it. I mean, summer's always a difficult time, and you might want to take it off now and come back on in September. That's the thing is, I mean, anything will sell depending on the right price. And prices are dropping a bit in London, a lot of it because of the foreign investors coming in. So, you know, anything will sell at the right price. But perhaps it also might need just a refresh, really, and another little look. People get tired when they see the same listings over and over again.
Simon, what are we seeing here? Fact or fear, wobble, substantial shift?
Bit of concern, bit of worry. Bit of our former Chancellor wandering around telling people that house prices were going to fall if we voted for Brexit. Mm-hmm. So understandably, people have thought, house prices might fall because we voted for Brexit. And so you saw a slowdown before the vote and you've seen it continue after the vote. In some areas, I don't think you're really seeing it at all. My sister is trying to buy a house in Canterbury and it's certainly not evident there. On the other hand, a friend of mine is trying to sell a house just outside Brighton, and apparently it is definitely evident there. What's interesting, actually, about the Zoopla stats is that it was suggested that the big Brexit effect was going to be London and, you know, London and the surrounding commuter belt. Because you've got that thing where you've got foreigners buying, but also you've got people who work for banks and city institutions and things like that. And that's where a lot of the uncertainty off the back of Brexit is going to be, surrounding jobs and investment. And, you know, is my employer going to decide to move to Frankfurt or Paris? And if my employer does decide to move to Frankfurt or Paris, I probably shouldn't move home and buy that house and spend all that money on stamp duty and lock into that mortgage. But it's been the north where we've seen these areas, the top 10 areas with the highest proportion of asking price cuts: Huddersfield, Wigan, St Helens, Middlesbrough, Wirral, Great Yarmouth, Halifax, Bishop Auckland, Rotherham, Stockton-on-Tees. None of which are known for their financial centres, I should add.
No. Then what's the explanation of that?
Well, it just shows that this confidence issue caused by Brexit is not just confined to the overpriced, you know, London and South East markets. You know, but even if you go to those places, house prices are still expensive because, you know, they might be lower, but wages are lower there as well. And obviously there's people there and businesses there that are concerned, and people are understandably, in the face of uncertainty, sitting on their hands and not making a couple of £100,000 purchase or £100,000 purchase.
What's your views, Rachel? Could Brexit be the thing that finally stops soaring prices? The way the article is written, Brexit bonanza for property hunters, particularly first-time buyers, if, and a big if there, you can manage to save for a sizeable deposit.
You can't possibly have the level of growth that we've had over the past few years. So something will curb it. And it's all about sentiment. So perhaps, but it's one of those things, you need a trigger and then for it to continue. But it just goes to show, I mean, the Zoopla stats say that the average discount is £25,257, which is an average year's salary.
Mm-hmm.
That's so much money just because prices are that high at the moment. So if you are buying at the moment, I mean, chance it. Can you imagine just whacking off 25 grand off your mortgage? That's another bedroom, isn't it, really? It's all about sentiment. You can only do your best try. And I suppose as a seller as well, be aware that, I don't know, look at the stats, see what other people are offering in your area. Are buyers now expecting reductions?
I also want to know, Simon, throw in sort of foreign ownership. We've been talking about that as well. Buy to let, what impacts have all of these had? I mean, it can't just be Brexit, can it? I mean, the market was all over the shop anyway.
There's a lot of the buy to let effect coming in, and I think that we shouldn't underestimate how much that rush to buy, you know, buy to lets before the stamp duty hike came in April, pulled forward a lot of purchases that might have been made in the rest of the year. And if anything's going to cause a turn in the housing market, that's likely to be it. But in all reality, basically, if you're buying a house or you're selling a house, those people selling are very likely to be buying another one, and they're very likely to be buying another one that is more expensive, and, you know, more people upsize than downsize. And so actually house prices that are lower are a benefit to you, because, you know, you might get less for your property, but the property that you're buying you will pay less for. And proportionally, that might actually, you know, if it stays the same, then that gives you a bigger sort of cash saving. And if you're a buyer, then times like this, when people are uncertain and people are cutting prices, that's the time to be buying. You don't want to be buying when everyone's going, woohoo, everything's great. You want to be buying when everyone's worried.
Simon, we're going to be getting on to, you take aim at inheritance tax a little bit later, but Rachel, actually, you've got a bit grumpy with your typewriter. And you've been penning, the government has gambled hundreds of millions on house price rises. It's time to stop the meddling, you say. The floor is yours.
So this is the other thing, actually, that could move the housing market. Is it really depends on what our new Chancellor and what Theresa May has in store. She did mention in her first speech that she was, when she was talking about inequality, she talked about people, young people who weren't able to get onto the housing ladder. So what will she offer them? What I have been arguing is the best thing probably that they could do is nothing. All of this kind of meddling to prop up the market, to effectively throwing cash at first-time buyers, may be good in the short term for those buyers who otherwise wouldn't get onto the property ladder, but it only goes, you know, the more money that you're throwing at the market, the higher prices go, the bigger the impact on everyone. The one I specifically was talking about was Help to Buy, which was launched by George Osborne when, short of any other better ideas to boost the economy, decided to throw more money at first-time buyers to get them on the property ladder. It's a scheme that allows you to borrow a proportion of the value of your home from the government. It helps if you have a small deposit. So say if you've only got 5%, that's often not enough to get a mortgage, and if you do, you'll get quite a high rate because rates tend to be higher when you don't have so much equity to put in yourself. So the government will boost it by, say, 20%. But the value of this loan is not fixed in monetary terms. It's fixed as a proportion of the value of your home. So if the value of your home goes up, then so does the value of that loan. So you have to pay the government back more money. Presumably you don't mind so much because the value of your home's gone up. It's not that big a deal. If the value of your home declines when you go to sell it, the value of your loan has also decreased. So it's been quite a good bet, really, for the government the last few years, because in general, there's been about 81,000 homes that people have used Help to Buy loans. It's been quite a good bet so far. People have, in general, the value of those properties will have risen. But if property values do start to decline, that is a massive shortfall that is going to be on the taxpayer. So about £3.5 billion, I think, so far has been given out in these Help to Buy loans. Say if the value of those properties decreases by just 10%, it's about 350 million that a shortfall that we're just going to have to suck up as taxpayers. And it's not just Help to Buy. There are all these little schemes all over the place to help people out. And the next one we've got is this Lifetime ISA. And I absolutely see that for the people that they are supporting, they're really helpful, and that's great, and it's nice that we're trying to do something, but maybe the best thing to do now is nothing.
We're going to be moving on to annuity payouts slashed again after this week's rate cut. Before we do that, one other house story or mortgage-related story I want to ask you very quickly. And nationwide, the latest lenders say it will pass on the Bank of England's interest rate cuts. Now, it's reducing interest payments by 0.25% for its base rate, standard mortgage and tracker mortgage holders. Barclays, Santander, Tesco, HSBC said at least some of their mortgage customers will benefit from last week's decision. Now, I wanted to ask you too, with the rate cut from the Bank of England, another perhaps expected before the end of the year, you say mortgage brokers are being bombarded with calls from homeowners asking if they should switch to a tracker deal. So should we track? Should we fix? What is the answer to this?
If you wanted a tracker mortgage, you should have taken one out some time ago. There's no point taking one out now. Basically, all the lenders have bumped up the rates on their tracker mortgages because they knew what the direction, they decided what the direction of travel was for interest rates, and that was down. So they knew that basically anybody they put on a tracker mortgage would see their payments go down. Whereas if they thought interest rates were going to go, the best time to take a tracker mortgage is when mortgage lenders think mortgage rates are going, when think interest rates are going to go up, and then they get it wrong, because then they trim the margin. And also, if you look at a lot of trackers, they're actually more expensive than fixed, than a comparable fix now. I've got a tracker mortgage. I've had a tracker mortgage for the last 5 years, and when I remortgaged 2 years ago, I took another tracker mortgage. Because I thought that interest rates weren't going up anytime soon, but also because I've got a lifetime tracker mortgage. And the reason why I took that is because basically it means there's no early repayment charges and I can leave anytime I want. And I thought that we might end up moving home. Now, theoretically, I could go get myself a 2 year fixed rate that is now quite a lot cheaper than that tracker, but then I'll be locked in for the next 2 years. So you've got to think about the early repayment charges there. I mean, a lot of people are calling up mortgage brokers and saying, what should they do? And mortgage brokers basically love two-year fixes, and they'll say, you should take a two-year fix. Now, I think that that is wrong for many people, because I think that in 2 years' time, they'll end up paying an extra set of fees. They'll have to think about their mortgage again. 2 years is a period of time that passes quite quickly. Yes, arguably, interest rates could be around about the same level in 2 years' time. I struggle to see how they would be lower. Mm-hmm. Mortgage rates would be lower in 2 years' time. Perhaps they will be, but I don't think you'd save yourself a huge amount of money, because mortgage rates on two-year fixes are now so low that I don't see how they could go much lower. And realistically, most people normally spend about 5 years in a property, and actually they just don't want to think about remortgaging. Remortgaging is a massive hassle for them. If we have another banking crisis, you might find that the base rate doesn't go anywhere and mortgage rates go up. But the key reason why I think many mortgage brokers say to people, you should take a two-year fix, is because in 2 years' time, you'll pay a mortgage broker again and they'll get another commission from the lender. I've spoken to brokers and they say, yeah, actually, there's a lot of that goes on amongst their more unscrupulous colleagues. So I'm not saying a two-year fix is a bad move. Mm. I'm just saying if a mortgage broker tells you to take a two-year fix, ask them why they aren't telling you to take a five-year fix.
Which is very interesting if you look at the article. Oh, right, the reason I was laughing there, Simon, is because, Rachel, you were shaking your head rather vigorously. Why is that?
It's cynical, but it's so true. Deals have never been this good on 5 year and 10 years. If you have any sort of idea about where you might be in 5 or 10 years time, perhaps you've just, you know, bought a big property that you expect you might be able to sort of grow into, then they're definitely worth considering, but just weighing up again with the early repayment charges.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio. The team from the finance website of the year, This Is Money, are in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NSNI editor Simon Lambert. Personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss are here now. Sticking with the base rate cut, not just impacting mortgages, but pensions. Have the Bank of England left retirees out in the cold, you're asking, with just £6 a day to live on? What's this about? Insurance giants Aviva, Legal & General, LV and Just Retirement have blamed the falling rates for wiping 8% off annuity rates, offering a paltry 2,000
£256 a year at most for every 100,000 that a married couple has in their pot. A decade ago, a 65-year-old with the same pot could get £7,092 a year. What is going on here, Rachel?
This is the Bank of England sort of sacrificing savers and pensioners, really, for the sake of the economy. They would argue there's no point in having a great pension if the whole economy is in disarray and there's, you know, mass unemployment, things like that, interest rates all over the place and inflation all over the place. But pensioners are really going to struggle now. We thought annuity rates were bad a year ago. You should see them now.
But I don't understand. Why should, if the rate's been cut 0.25, why are we looking at an 8% cut here?
That's a good question.
Why so big?
It's the annuity rates are dependent on the rate on gilts. Mm-hmm. And the rate on gilts has decreased because that, again, is connected to the Bank of England's base rate. So with gilts so low, the annuity rates are falling. And that means a considerably lower payout if you have an annuity. There's also implications if you have a final salary pension scheme. Mm-hmm. These again are linked to gilts, and so the returns that employers are seeing on them are dropping at an extraordinary rate, and we're ending up with these huge deficits that the pension providers, company pension providers, are facing. And we don't really know yet what the fallout is going to be. If this is sustained, then this deficit will just continue to increase year on year. Mm. And they simply won't be able to pay out everything that they've promised. So the question then is, what do they do? Do they? Ruth Lyth from Money Mill had an interesting story today about one potential fallout, which is employers trying to wriggle out of their obligations. So giving you incentives to take a lower payout on your pensions. We could see more companies defaulting on their pension schemes. It is enough to sink a company potentially if you've got that kind of level of debt. It's going to play out pretty horribly for the next few years, assuming that rates stay this low.
Just a quick one. Well, firstly, annuities have plummeted anyway in terms of those taking them out since the pension freedoms in April 2015. We're looking at figures of 400,000 a year to 80,000 today. But what is the advice if you are retiring now, within the next month? There's not really a lot you can do, is there?
Put it off.
Except put it off.
Yeah, really, put it off. I mean, for sure, shop around. It seems so obvious, but people generally don't at the moment. The company with whom you've been building up your pension will get in touch with you and say, would you like to convert this into an annuity? At which point you say, no, thank you very much. I'm going to see if I can get a better deal. If you are in poor health, then the chances are that you are eligible for an enhanced annuity. That's more money.
Or if you smoke. Or
yeah, something like that. Yeah, because you'll have a lower life expectancy. So shop around. Think twice before you opt for an annuity. You don't have to get one anymore. You did before pension freedoms. Now you can do some kind of drawdown scheme, so you can sort of invest your money to draw an income. But returns on that have been pretty volatile as well, because the stock market's been all over the place. So that's difficult. I mean, put it off if you can. Work longer, or if you there is also a case for sort of looking at your whole portfolio, if you're lucky enough to have one, and consider what's worth kind of drawing on first and what's worth leaving untapped.
The thing is, now looks like a pretty awful time to buy an annuity, right? So if you are retiring right now, then you should be aware that now looks pretty terrible for buying it and using your pension pot to buy an annuity. If we go back to the gilts thing, 10-year UK government gilts are currently yielding the princely sum of 0.55%. A year ago, that was 1.8%. That is a big, big drop. Problem was, a year ago looked like a pretty awful time to be buying an annuity. So you might have been told to hold off then. Mm-hmm. But if you'd have bought one then, you'd be in a much better position than you would be now. Realistically, though, I mean, you know, we're right at the point where the Bank of England has just announced another load of QE, right? QE involves basically buying up government bonds. It buys government bonds. By buying government bonds, it basically pushes up the price of them, which pushes down the yield on them. So you would look at the scenario now and you'd have to make a decision that says, do I think we're just going to get like endless QE, or do I think that we're going to get this, maybe another burst of it, and then it's going to stop? Because if it does stop, then theoretically, those gilt yields should improve, and so should those annuity rates. But you just don't
Nothing
know.
Nothing is guaranteed.
Nothing's guaranteed, but, you know, it's phenomenally low gilt yields at the moment. I think this is a genuine issue with what the Bank of England is doing. The Bank of England knew that this was going to hit pensions. It knew it was going to hit pensions that were already possibly delivering some of the worst rates that's delivered. And I'm not even so sure that, you know, chucking this load of money into the financial system is such a good idea. I think there are much better ways of using the money. Mm. But, you know, it's been done now. You can't do anything about it. But what I would say is, if this is going to be a real issue for you, you should consider investing in some financial advice, basically. Most people balk at the cost of like £1,000, £1,500, £2,000 to sort out their pension, especially if your pension pot's like, you know, £40,000. That's a big chunk of it. But that financial advice might get you more money every single month for the rest of your life and more than pay back the amount of money that you spend on it. You know, maybe ask your employer, say, will you contribute to the cost of the financial advice? You know, doesn't hurt. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Absolutely.
And,
right.
And also the other thing I would say is, you know, listen to that financial advice. But also, as Rachel said, think about ways that you could earn some extra money, because it might be that you don't want to keep working. But if you could earn an extra £200 a month, you know, by doing something part time or doing some little bit of work somewhere or switching on your entrepreneurial skills, that might make a real difference to your income.
Just a quick one, Simon. Number of investment trusts yielding 4% or more falls by a quarter as share prices rise in Brexit Britain. What's going on here?
Share prices have gone up, which means that the price of buying those trusts has gone up, which means that the yield has fallen at the same time as companies are cutting their dividends. So you've got a squeeze at both ends. Means it's basically getting harder to get an income. And investment trusts are a great place to get income because they have this structure that allows them to hold over some of the money in the good times in order to help them pay out dividends in the bad times. So they are definitely something that people should be considering if they're looking for income.
And also, you've been looking at the fact the Bank of England saying that it wanted to encourage investors to take more risk means ditching safe but low-paying bank deposit accounts. The higher the risk, of course, the bigger the potential for returns and for losses. So how can you make money in this post-Brexit Britain without gambling your nest egg away? Now, Rachel, you've been looking at a few options here, haven't you? You've been looking at current accounts, premium bonds, also the stock market, a new one here, peer-to-peer lending, and rating the risk factors. Just briefly run us through some of those.
Well, first of all, you can't really. You can't grow your nest egg without some kind of risk. It's just how much you want to take on. Well, current accounts is one option, actually, which is risk-free. Some of them pay really good rates of interest, but there are sort of various caveats. You have to sometimes pay in a grand a month, things like that. And
watch out for cuts as well.
Yeah,
or
sometimes.
Or increase in
charges. Yeah, they'll often use it to lure you in. But there are some really good ones. Still, if it stays, it's unclear whether it will. But at the moment, the Santander 123 account is really good. Premium bonds, that is risk-free. But, I mean, there is the risk that you won't win anything. Mm-hmm. And then you're not exactly growing your nest egg. Peer-to-peer saving is increasingly popular, but that's definitely... Moneymail's given it a risk rating of 2 out of 5. Yeah, I'd say it's maybe higher. They are sort of very new and it's still quite untested. Shares, same old, but... prices are quite high at the moment. Mm. Then there's slightly more precarious things that they do mention.
Wine, gold,
and cars, which slightly perturbed about because they don't really offer a return. I mean, I suppose a car could if you rent it out, but gold doesn't typically offer a return. You just have to hold them and hope that they increase in value and then sell them when they do. Retail bonds and bonds, again, sort of depending on what you opt for, varying degrees of risk.
So there are a few options there. Do take a look at the website for more information on this. But Simon, have you had a nice breather? Because before we take off on our travels, one more issue at home we have to deal with, and that is the perennially controversial favourite of taxes. Inheritance tax.
Inheritance tax is a tax effectively designed to charge gifts that are made either on death or during lifetime from one person to another person. Now, most people will always associate with death because that's the point at which we all understand that inheritance tax may be payable, and it's payable at 40%, as everybody knows, and you have your nil rate band set against that. That's not the only time it's in fact chargeable. It can be chargeable on some lifetime gifts as well. It really depends how things are structured, but it's a tax that can bite on any transfer from one person to another, although most of the time it doesn't, because most lifetime gifts are covered by exemptions. There's the idea that I have a lot of sympathy with, to be honest, where people will say, well, if I've earned the money, I've paid income tax at the point where I've earned it, and then I have to pay another 40% inheritance tax if I haven't spent it by the time I die. It does seem extremely unfair on that basis. Against that, you would have people arguing that without something, some mechanism to tax transfers from one generation to another, you could have people who just consistently passed down through the family, and therefore that person who's now leaving it didn't actually earn it at all. They were merely left it by a recent generation, which was left it by the further generation and so forth.
Well, that was Danny Clifford, a partner at Ensor's accountant. It's not always the case, though. Indeed, this week a certain Hugh Grosvenor got significantly richer after the death of his father, the Duke of Westminster. The 25-year-old avoids a significant cut to his £9 billion inheritance because the estate is held in a trust. So, Simon, you take aim this week, inheritance tax, capital gains tax. Indeed, you pretty much take aim at the whole tax system generally. You've got 2 minutes, go.
So, basically, inheritance tax is one that divides opinion, right? So some people think that it should just be got rid of altogether and that people should not be taxed for giving, you know, handing on money to their children. Other people argue that basically, you know, what it does is it basically perpetuates inequality, and that it should, that, you know, inheritance should be taxed, or that inheritance should be taxed more heavily. This isn't really about this. What this is about is basically the complexity of our tax system. And the fact that inheritance tax is something that basically highlights this perfectly. George Osborne, the Tories promised to raise the inheritance tax allowance to £1 million before the 2010 election. That was then scuppered by the coalition government. They were then, you know, elected to, you know, in government just by themselves. George Osborne, just over a year ago, stood up. Everyone thought he was going to raise inheritance tax for £1 million. But basically, under a bit of pressure, because he didn't want to be seen to be favouring the wealthy at a time of supposed austerity and all that, basically brought in this slightly bonkers system that you'd have the normal inheritance tax allowance of £325,000 per person that could be passed between a couple to double up to £650,000. And then he brought in this family home allowance, where basically everyone you would get an extra £175,000 to cover their main residence if it was passed down to a direct descendant, and then it would be phased in, but then also it would be gradually taken off people after a £2 million level of their estate. It's like ridiculously complicated. It introduces a whole extra element into inheritance tax that shouldn't be there, this thing of a family home. So basically a family home is this prized thing. It is the thing that has driven most people into the inheritance tax bracket, but why should it get a special favour? Why should someone who owns a home get a special favour over someone who rents a home but has built up a substantial amount of pot in investments? Why should someone who has children or grandchildren get special favours over people who don't have children or grandchildren? Why should a married couple get special favours over two sisters who own a house together, who could be forced to have to sell it on the death of one of them? There was a famous court case about that. And we were writing a guide to this the other day, and it is so unbelievably, stupidly, needlessly complicated that it got me thinking. And I said to Rachel, I said, I've got an idea. I think we got the Office for Budget Responsibility. What we need is an Office for Tax Simplicity. And basically, anything that's going to go into the budget, any tax changes, have to go before this Office of Tax Simplicity and its panel of normal, reasonable people. And if they cannot understand them without the briefest and simplest of explanations, then the tax is not allowed to go into the budget. And we should use this to basically simplify our tax system, because he didn't just do it with inheritance tax. He also did it with capital gains tax, where he raised it from 18% to 28% for higher rate taxpayers, but then bizarrely combined two taxes so that you add capital gains to your income to decide which rate was paid. He did it with income tax, which he cut from 50p to 45p, then started removing the personal allowance above £100,000 that created this weird 60% marginal tax rate. Gordon Brown one of his predecessors was notorious for this kind of stuff, introducing and then removing the 10p tax rate. And then I remembered that actually, basically, George Osborne did actually set up the Office for Tax Simplification in 2010 and then duly set about making tax substantially more complicated. So I think that the Office for Tax Simplification, we need to forget about that one. It's stuffed full of accountants and former Inland Revenue people who probably aren't best placed to decide whether something is complicated. And we need to bring in our new Office of Tax Simplicity, Office for Budget Simplicity, with normal people on it. And if they can't understand it, it's not allowed.
And on a previous show, you pointed the former Chancellor George Osborne to the website for your details that they can contact you. And I imagine the same holds true for Philip Hammond. Now, we were going to talk rip-off credit card charges, why it doesn't pay to pay in pounds and a trick to get a bit of cash from a missed flight. But I knew Simon would never stick to 2 minutes, so we don't have time. But the great thing is, it's all on thisismoney.co.uk. Editor Simon Lambert, Personal Finance Editor Rachel Regan-Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.